in Boston.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Giant fireballs lit up the night sky, and huge explosions rocked Baghdad as air raid sirens wailed. This was it, or something like it, the stunning war from the air. 320 cruise missiles raining down, 1,000 sorties against Iraqi targets so far. And on the ground, U.S. and British troops have reportedly seized two key airfields in western Iraq and strategic oil fields in the south. U.S. troops are now reportedly nearly halfway to Baghdad. Tonight on Point, we assess the air assault on Baghdad and overall progress in the war on Iraq. Good luck, bad luck, and surprises so far. We'll bring you fresh first-hand reports from the field, the latest news from the Pentagon, and we'll get in-depth perspective from top analysts on the day's events. Did you run to the sound of the bombing over Baghdad today? Did you think this war would be one great light show and over? Are you now prepared psychologically for a longer campaign, or do you think the end is nigh? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me in the studio, as he has every night since the war began, is retired U.S. Air Force Lieutenant General Tad Olstrom, a 35-year veteran of the Air Force at every level of command. He is now Director of the National Security Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Good evening and welcome back, General Olstrom.
Thanks, Tom.
Also in the studio tonight, Steve Van Evra, Director of the Security Studies Program at MIT and author of Causes of War, Power, and Roots of Conflict. Good to have you back, Stephen Van Evra.
Thanks, Tom.
And we begin in Washington with John Hendren, Pentagon correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, who has been closely following all the day's developments. Good evening and welcome, John Hendren.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you, John. We got the first in-depth briefing today from Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Myers. What's the top-line message?
Well, the top-line message, of course, is that the air war has begun, and that was what was to be the long-awaited beginning of the entire campaign, but in fact, it wasn't the first strike. It was really sort of the third strike. First thing that happened, of course, was the strike on a compound in Baghdad. And then yesterday, you had the ground war beginning before the air war, which is a reverse of the 1991 Gulf War program.
So what's the word from the top brass there, John Hendren? Is this according to plan? Are they now improvising as they go, given events and opportunities? Is this unfolding as Rumsfeld and General Myers would like to see it unfold?
I'm told that there is a lot of improvisation, but that it's all intentional. Often you've got improvisation because things don't go as well as you think they are. In this case, General Franks yesterday decided to send forth the Army 3rd Division and Marine Division ahead of time because the Iraqis were burning the oil, were starting to burn a few of the oil fields, and also because they were bringing artillery down apparently from southward toward Kuwait. So there was some improvisation going on there, and it looks like otherwise they're pretty much ahead of schedule.
So, in that picture, what is the meaning, what was the intent of today's much bigger bombardment of Baghdad and the northern cities of Mosul and Kirkuk? We had, of course, been led to expect this as the opening salvo of this war. That didn't happen. As you say, we kind of stepped into it. Was this equivalent to what the Pentagon's been promising and Rumsfeld's been threatening for weeks, the shock and awe trauma that would sort of bring Iraq crumbling to its knees? Or was this some modified version given events?
No, it does seem to be, you know, the original campaign we'd been warned about. We were told it would be relentless, and of course, if there's one phrase that's going to come out of this war, it's going to be shock and awe. It seems to be having some effect. You've got today the first whole Army division surrendering from Iraq.
This is Iraq's 51st.
That's right, and you've also had smaller groups surrendering before that, and then apparently there are some surrender discussions going on between U.S. Special Forces and perhaps other U.S. government agencies and a Republican Guard unit.
So surrenders, John, for those of us who aren't military folks, the 51st Division of Iraq's military surrendering, how many troops might that indicate? Do you have any idea of the scale, the number?
It's in a thousand. I don't know the size of their divisions right offhand, but we're the general may be able to help with this, but we're talking about several thousand.
General Ostrom, what about it? Does that sound like what it would be?
They're typically smaller than ours, and I would say in the range of probably 7,000 to 10,000 might be closer to their sizes.
But that's quite a significant number of troops
surrendered. Yes.
And where were those troops, John Hendren?
You know, to tell you the truth, I'm not exactly clear on that at the moment.
So somewhere in Iraq, a division has come across with a white flag. What about in the north?
Apparently that was in southern Iraq, incidentally.
Right. On the northern border, very mixed signals throughout the day today. We heard first that Turkey had opened the airspace, then that they could not come to terms with the U.S. over permitting Turkish troops into northern Iraq, Kurdistan, the Kurdish zone, and they did not open the airspace. By the end of the day, we're reading they opened the airspace, but the United States demanded that they not move troops into northern Iraq, and Turkey has begun to do that anyway. Is that what you understand, John Hendren?
That story's been fuzzy all day. I won't challenge that account. I know early in the day that we were told that we were not using the airspace, and that a few days ago there was apparently an incident in which we made a special request to use Turkish airspace and in order to offer close air support to some ground units, and they turned us down for that. So there are no special allowances going on there, and it's been a difficult negotiation all along.
So if we kind of picture the map of Iraq then tonight, we see a lot of bombs falling on Baghdad and the other two northern cities, Mosul and Kirkuk. We read that British soldiers have taken the southernmost tip of Iraq, where the southern oil fields are. We have some oil fires there, but that seems fairly well in hand, along with the big ports there. Is that right, John?
That's right.
And then U.S. forces shooting up from Kuwait, we're told, 100 miles or so into Iraq, which would be somewhere a third or halfway to Baghdad.
Right. You've got apparently the Marines going up the Euphrates Valley and the 3rd Infantry Division going more toward the west, both of them headed toward Baghdad. And I've heard optimistic predictions that they could reach there in as few as 3 days.
3 days. And as far as the air campaign goes, we had earlier heard 3,000 cruise missiles in the first attack on Baghdad. Instead, today we saw 300. Does that mean that there's much more to come, or will this be staggered depending on events?
It may be staggered depending on events. In particular, if you've got units that are surrendering, you don't want to target them.
Steve Van Evra, overall then, how do you look at the success of this campaign so far? What surprises for good and ill?
Overall, I think the campaign's gone well so far, although we haven't yet gotten to the point where we would encounter the big dangers that worry people, the kind of points at which the campaign can go south. It seems to me that the big unexpected positive development is the signs of crumbling and surrender that we're seeing on the Iraqi side. There have been, you mentioned the surrender of the 51st Division. We also have heard a lot of rumor of surrender arrangements with other units, other Iraqi army units. And I also think one of the reasons why we launched the ground attack early is because we were making deals with I'm totally speculating here,
All
but
right.
I think that we launched the ground attack early because we didn't see much force in our way. And what we weren't seeing was Iraqi units ready to fight because they'd already cut deals with us.
So why not get closer to Baghdad in that
right,
case?
Exactly. And all this reflects, by the way, a very smart thing that the U.S. military did in advance of this war, which was to put itself in personal contact with large numbers of Iraqi officers. We've never done anything quite like this before. The military were sending emails to Iraqi commanders, calling them on their cell phones.
They actually had, we heard this report, they actually had their cell phone numbers, their email addresses, and it's a direct line.
I'm dying to know where they got them. Did you call, Baghdad information? Or where'd they get the numbers? But the point is, people don't surrender if they don't know what deal they're going to get. They need to know how to surrender. They need to know the protocol for it. They need to know how to cross the line without getting shot. They need to know what deal they're going to get if they do, because Saddam is going to tell them that we're going to hurt him. So this so-called PSYOP was a very very smart part of the campaign.
That we heard today from Donald Rumsfeld, General Ostrom, that there is not an overall surrender conversation going on, that it's unit by unit, that it's individual commanders. But he said, as Stephen Van Evra just has, Rumsfeld said, the regime is starting to lose control of their country. The confusion of Iraqi officials is growing. Their ability to see what is happening on the battlefield, to communicate with their forces and to control control of the country is slipping away. Is that how it looks to you, or is this psyops from Washington?
No, I think it probably looks that way. And, of course, the information is relatively fragmented at this particular time. While John's still on the phone, I'd like to ask him whether or not he's heard anything relative to the surrendering of the 51st, since I have not seen detail on it. But one of the subjects that we had discussed earlier is the use of the term capitulation versus making them prisoners of war. It's a different responsibility that we would have. And I was wondering if John had heard anything relative to the 51st, whether or not they capitulated, which allows us to just take their weapons and put them off on the side and not give them POW.
So the distinction there, and we'll get John's word on this, but the distinction there is capitulation. Is it a formal term in wartime that permits, or it's a we'll make it up on the battlefield, we don't want to make you POWs, in fact, we may make you allies, kind of a...
Well, the thought was is that, and again, I have not heard the use of the term capitulation before, but there is some formality with prisoner of war. We have to take them in, we have to treat them as prisoners of war. But in capitulation, the thought was is that we could take units like that, strip them of their weapons, actually leave their command channels intact, and let them be responsible for themselves in this particular area, maybe keep them in a constrained area, but not have to worry about them like we have to with a prisoner of war, feed,
which is a heavy burden. Right. John Hendren, what do you know about that?
It's my understanding that that's what we're doing, in fact, not taking them as prisoners of war, but instead just taking their weapons. And that among the leaflets that were dropped ahead of time were one that said, you can just lay down your arms and officers can actually keep their sidearms. I mean, these are very loose rules, I think, intended to avoid encumbering U.S. forces with having to deal with a lot of these people who would otherwise be prisoners of war.
I wonder if even more than that, Stephen Van Evere, in the messages in recent days from George Bush and from Donald Rumsfeld, I've almost heard an echo that if Iraqi troops and commanders in particular came in soon without fighting, they might actually be part of the new government.
Well, I think the main deal we're offering these commanders is if you capitulate, we won't kill you. I don't think we're cutting deals.
Not more than that.
No, I doubt very much we're cutting any deal with them to the effect that you'll get, you know, a piece of the government. There is this whole issue later, which is what are we going to do with the Ba'ath elite and the military elite later? To what degree are we going to be relying on
the whole infrastructure under Saddam Hussein?
Right, right. And I hope myself that we make deep reform, that we sweep away the great bulk of the Tikrit mafia that Saddam has around him. I hope we are not going to be relying too heavily on high-level Saddam folk to run the government. I'm afraid we may do it because it's the easy thing to do.
Because they're in place. They know where the files are. They know where the wires are hooked up.
Exactly. But it wouldn't be the smart thing for us to do.
John Hendren, looking out from your vantage there, what might the next couple of days look like? Are we going to see more huge blasts over Baghdad, or is that a one-time thing? Is this a story of more thrust toward the capital?
Well, I'm guessing there are going to be some more big booms. They had pre-designated something like 7,000 targets, and we've been told that there would be hundreds more strikes over the next 24 hours, mostly on these command and control nodes. In other words, they're deliberately sparing the regular army unless they seem to pose an immediate threat.
And John, finally, what do you hear on the civilian casualty front? Where were the bombs dropping in Baghdad today, and do we know anything about who has died in this bombing?
We don't know a whole lot about it. We have been assured that these strikes are, of course, more precise than any we've seen before, and they are using something like 9 out of 10 precision-guided bombs, meaning satellite or laser-guided, and those are generally more accurate. And we just don't have a lot of information on that.
And may not for some time if it's true to form. John Hendren, thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's been great having you.
Thank you.
John Hendren is Pentagon correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. We are talking tonight about the air assault on Baghdad and where we are now in the war on Iraq. Did you run to the sound of the booms? How do you interpret the sound and fury? Did you think it would be one light show and over? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm in the studio tonight with General Tad Olstrom, Director of the National Security Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and Steve Van Evere, Director of MIT's Security Studies Program. You can join us as well, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point today. The Pentagon unleashed a massive air assault on Baghdad and at least two other Iraqi cities to the north. Tonight we're bringing you fresh first-hand reports on the day's action and what it means. You can join the conversation. What do you see unfolding in the war in Iraq? Does this war feel on track to you? Do you see a strategy emerging from the smoke and dust? We are at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. James Pinkerton is a correspondent for the Houston Chronicle with the U.S. Air Force, 386th Air Expeditionary Wing. He spoke with me from an air base on the Iraqi border where American troops have been pouring into southern Iraq for days. I asked him to describe the role of the 386th Air Expeditionary Wing.
The job of this outfit here is to support an air base. One of its functions is to recover any airplanes that are damaged during an attack like this evening.
Do the soldiers there, James, have an awareness of what's going on in Baghdad and other cities? Are they even plugged into that news or not?
Most definitely. There are widescreen televisions in both of the mess halls. Part of this base is a permanent installation, and they have very good telecommunications, and virtually the whole base, if they're near a TV, are watching it this evening. They're all saying it's kind of surreal.
Has there been a lot of anticipation of this? Have the troops been waiting for this or hoping that it wouldn't come?
Yes, I think they have, and I guess to put it in context, in the last 24 hours, beginning at noon yesterday, there have been a series of red alerts at the base, which requires everyone to don their gas masks and go to a bunker. And today at noon, there was a missile come by, and the Patriot batteries here at this base fired off three shots. So there's been a lot of people here have been very anxious about what's going on up north.
James, you've written, and of course, we know in its December report to the United Nations weapons inspectors, Iraq declared that it no longer had Scud missiles. Was it a surprise to people that they suddenly came up out of the woodwork?
No, I don't think anybody on this base was surprised. From the time that I got here, they were all training very hard for that eventuality. They all told us to expect a Scud attack. No one here believed that there were not any missiles in Iraq's inventory. They were all sure that they would be fired this way, and sure enough, they were. Like I said, beginning noon yesterday, there have been at least 5 to 7 Scuds have been shot down.
Now, while troops are getting their gas masks and suits on and getting into bunkers, what are the operational activities they've been doing? Have they been sending out aircraft in support of the movement in the south? What's the activity been?
Yes, there's a huge complement here of mostly U.S. Marine helicopters of all descriptions. And their job is to take cargo and troops into Iraq. That's been going on the one hand. There was also a British Tornado unit, and they just left. A wave of them left at about the time this attack began.
And do you have a sense from returning troops, James, of whether or not they're happy with the way things are going?
I'd say everybody is very pleased with the way it's going. Everybody here wants this to be resolved quickly. The common phrase among the people here is they have families, they want to go home to them, they want this to be over quickly, and they feel like they've trained and prepared for a very quick victory. And I think they've been heartened by some of the early report of Iraqi soldiers surrendering. I think the universal feeling is we're glad it came, finally.
James Pinkerton, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
James Pinkerton is a correspondent for the Houston Chronicle with the U.S. Air Force 386th Air Expeditionary Wing. Tad Olstrom, General Olstrom, we spoke last night when this big airborne blow to Baghdad had not really come yet about the possibility that Washington was hoping that by threatening it so loudly and so fiercely, they would kind of shake loose top dogs and lots of troops out of the Iraqi military structure, that in fact they might never have to deliver it because of the destruction that it necessarily entails. So what's your assessment today? Did they give up on that? Did they not see the Iraqi structure shaking loose under the threat as they hoped it might? Is that what's going on here? Did they decide that the destruction was necessary to push ahead?
I think it's one of those where they saw some signs, and I think the Secretary of Defense this afternoon in his statements mentioned that there were some signs, certainly, of the command and control breaking up and the leadership being somewhat detached, but it wasn't significant enough. The point, at least at that point, I believe the decision needed to be made that we needed to take it up to the next step. There's only so long you can pause before you give them some real advantages in my mind.
To recoup, regroup, reorient.
Exactly.
Stephen Everett, what about that? The images today, in some ghoulish way, you could feel America waiting for them. At the same time, because this is what we've come to associate with the beginning of war. This had been the promised display. At the same time, these are images of destruction. And you've spoken with us about how much of the world, and particularly the Arab world, is not eager to see great destruction here as Saddam is removed. How does this play? Was this something done very reluctantly, or was this a necessary part of the campaign?
Oh, I think it was a necessary part of the campaign. I think the purpose of today's attacks is basically to sever the government and the military command from the forces, and it's a standard part of any war. You go for the so-called C-cubed attack. You try to destroy the command apparatus, and if you can do that, you can shorten the war by making the forces ineffective without destroying them. We won't know if this how well this worked for several days. Hours have to go by before we find out if we've really succeeded. My expectation is that we probably did very well because we've been studying this country's communications and command structure for a long, long time. The weapons we use today were very accurate. So I'm expecting to hear good news, but we haven't heard it yet. Now, I do think that the visuals matter a whole lot here because this war is embedded in a bigger one, and it's vital that this war
the bigger one being the global hearts and minds war and the regional hearts and minds.
Global hearts and minds, and especially the war in al-Qaeda, which depends on hearts and minds, especially in the Islamic world, but worldwide too. It's therefore essential that we spare civilians, that we not come up with a big butcher's bill of civilians. I think we are trying very hard not to kill civilians, and I think the visuals today were worse than the realities. I think when the dust settles, we're going to find that we killed very few civilians.
We're told that these were military sites, presidential palaces, carefully targeted sites away from civilian population.
Correct. That's my understanding.
Still, it's Baghdad, a city of 5 million.
That's true. But you've got to understand how much more precise these weapons are than the weapons we've ever used before. These are very, very accurate weapons. The JDAMs will fall within roughly 30 feet of an aim point.
JDAM standing for?
Joint...
Direct Attack Munition.
Right, Joint Direct Attack Munition. Thank you. And it's a new weapon. We used it for the first time in Afghanistan, and it exploits the GPS satellite system to drop a weapon to a precise point on the Earth's surface.
And those images really do matter, and there's a kind of a contest of images and messages here. We saw today on Al Jazeera, the Arab satellite television station that is watched all over the Middle East, French Prime Minister Jacques Chirac, of course, who has a very different line on everything going on than the U.S. I didn't actually get the audio on it, but you can well imagine that he was not singing the praises of what was being blown, the bomb and light show in Baghdad. General Ohlstrom, on this point of precision guided weapons, do you trust that these are as precise as advertised? After the first Gulf War, there was some question about that. What about this time?
I don't think there was too much question after the first Gulf War. We only had few compared to the number of non-precision guided munitions. And even the accuracy then at the end of the Gulf War, I think it was above 90%, probably closer to 95% all guided within the basket of anticipation. But there were some other problems associated with those because they were laser-guided bombs by and large, and they could indeed be taken off their mark by things like smoke and haze. So weather had a lot to do with it and the atmospherics. Mm-hmm. Not true with the Joint Direct Attack Munitions.
Describe to us, if you would, just kind of lay out how did this attack take place today. The first thing that most of us heard was the news that I believe B-52s had left Britain hours before the attack. So that's part of it. But then, of course, there are reports from all over the Gulf on the USS Kitty Hawk and Abraham Lincoln and maybe Constitution. I'm not sure of all, you know, of lots of aircraft taking off there. Just physically, practically, how does a very big precision guided attack like this take place? How is it unleashed?
Well, there's a simple piece of paper, if you can imagine, which is obviously much bigger than that, that has the air tasking order that essentially puts all the pieces together and forms the timing, the location where they would form up in maybe groups so they can have certain entry routes and recovery routes, deconfliction in altitudes, deconfliction in time, deconfliction over targets. All of that is built in by a computer now, but certainly there are people that are feeding that in this air tasking order. It impacts not only the tanker aircraft that refuel, it's the communications aircraft that are airborne. It's the intelligence airborne, the command and control airplanes, plus all the fighters and the bombers and the support aircraft. It's a very, very complicated scheme, if you would, but it brings it all together, and your job is to know what your part is and make sure that you are on time, en route.
To stay in a range of deconfliction, we always learn new vocabulary in these military conflicts. So the B-52s would be dropping what? 320 cruise missiles, we're told. I think those can come off the aircraft carriers. Do they also come from the big bombers?
They can. In fact, in the first Gulf War, we actually have seen B-52s dropping cruise missiles, and that was the way they were primarily used. But since that time, we have taken these very old weapon systems, the B-52. They now can drop the JDAMs like the other bombers, the B-1s and the B-2s. So it probably was some type of a combination. I certainly don't know what the ratio was, and they could have done both.
And then we hear radar jamming EA-6B Prowlers, presumably in the region of Baghdad and the other cities, blocking Iraqi radar so that they're not as able to bring down U.S. aircraft.
Again, there's a sequencing to bring in the jamming aircraft and bring in the suppression airplanes in case there are surface-to-air missiles or radars.
Suppression airplanes, is that Tomcats and Hornets?
No, the suppression would be those EA-6Bs and other fighters, because both the Navy will have some and the F-18s, the Air Force will use those, probably with F-16, that have air-to-surface missiles that will home in on radar signals. And they would be available to work with these EA-6Bs to locate those kind of ground defenses that could impact the airborne aircraft.
And a simple question, but every time we see these attacks over Baghdad, which has become kind of the arena, the visual arena that's in everyone's mind now, we see what looks like gobs of anti-aircraft fire going up, but we don't see American airplanes coming down, falling out of the sky. Why not?
The real difference here is that most of that AAA, as we call it, anti-aircraft fire, has some real limits in altitude, and only the bigger systems, which are slow rate of fire, will get up to the altitude that we are allowed to drop at now. So we'll be doing most of our dropping probably above 25 or 30,000 feet, of which there will probably be less than 5% maybe of the AAA that will get up to that same altitude.
We're talking tonight about the air assault on Baghdad and where we are now in the war on Iraq. What do you see unfolding in this war? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Jeff's calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Good, thanks.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is as follows. Given that we now see that the Turkish army is probably going to move into the Kurdish Iraq territory.
Seems to be, over great American protest.
Yeah, and also given that the arrangement that we've set up, we don't have the ability to run flights out of our air base in Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
We have flyover rights. If the Turks decide to go after the Kurds, or if the vice versa, if the Kurds decide they don't want the Turks there and get into a fight with them, how are we going to be able or even willing to do anything to stop that? I don't see how we're going to even be able to get in there.
That is a great question. Let me put it to Stephen Van Ever. Jeff, thanks for your call. Steve, do we have a potential war within a war brewing here in the northern area of Iraq?
What Jeff points to is a big mess, a real problem here, a real headache that we have not sorted out, and we better handle this right and handle it quick because it can turn into something terrible. I'm quite amazed to see the Turks actually defying us and moving into northern Iraq. And the backdrop to this, people have to understand, is the tremendous hatred between the Kurds and the Turks.
The Turks have an enormous Kurdish population within their boundaries that they have had an internal guerrilla war with for many years.
Correct. 15 years, longer than that. They suppressed it with great brutality. brutality. They also provoked it with really vicious discrimination against the Kurds. They made it illegal to speak the Kurdish language. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't even refer to the Kurds as Kurds. They called them Mountain Turks.
Right down to the school level, sort of whacking the kids when they spoke Kurdish.
Correct. And as a result of all this, a lot of the Kurds in northern Iraq, if you ask them who's the biggest enemy of the Kurdish people, is it Saddam or the Turks? They'll say it's the Turks.
So what would the Turkish forces have in mind here? How deep into northern Iraq, or what to their astonishment is often now called Kurdistan, as it's emerged under the no-fly zone, how far might they go? What goal in mind?
Well, I'm puzzled what they think they're doing, but if I was to guess, I think they're trying to create basically a Turkish sphere of influence here to deter or prevent the Kurds from declaring independence. I think this is something that very foolish from the Turks to do. Point one, we can prevent the Kurds from declaring independence, and we're willing to do it, and they should rely on us to do that. Mm-hmm. Point two, if they flex too much muscle here, they're going to wind up in a fight with the Kurds. The Kurds are tough guys, and they've got a long record of playing tough, and we're going to see fighting up there, which is to no one's interest.
Might they not even end up in a fight with U.S. forces? Because we have promised the territorial integrity of Iraq. It's hard to make a case for that if they've got Turkish forces sitting all over the northern region.
I think it's very unlikely but conceivable that some kind of standoff between U.S. forces and the Turks will take place. I think it's much more likely we're going to see Turks fighting Kurds, or way down the road, if we mishandle this and we pay off the Turks too much in the currency of Kurdish freedom. Mm-hmm. Now, there's another mistake we could make here is by saying, okay, I've got to make the Turks happy. Let's agree to really stomp on the Kurds.
From Baghdad. Keep it very heavy-handed.
Let's not allow them autonomy or power sharing in Baghdad, which I think would be a big mistake. Then we're going to wind up with the Kurds very unhappy to us.
General Ullstrom, to Jeff's specific question, given that we have only flyover rights in Turkey, we don't have land access, is it possible that the Turks can act, with impunity up here, and the U.S. can't really do anything about it?
I don't think it's quite that far, because with overflight access, that gives us ability, if we need to come across the airspace and come into northern Iraq and do the things that we have to do.
But the Turks could presumably, they can just drive in. They could have 10,000, 20,000 troops in there in a matter of, you tell me.
Well, I don't think we're in a position to prevent them from coming across with ground troops. But in order to do other parts of the conflict, I think we can do that now with the airspace coming either from the south or from the west or from the north with overflight of Turkey.
Enough that we could stop a conflict between the Kurds and the Turks?
I don't believe that at this particular time, no.
You don't believe we could stop it, or you don't believe it'll happen?
I don't believe we could stop it at this time if indeed there was a conflict.
Oh, Jeff, you've put your finger on a really tough barrel of issues right there. What's our leverage on this northern front? We don't want Iraq beginning to fall apart even before the job is done, Stephen Van Evra.
Well, we've got a lot of leverage. The question is how to put the pieces together and make it work. In the end, we're going to dominate Iraq militarily. In the end, the Turks are going to have to respect our power, because even though we don't have forces there now, look ahead a month. If we want to have a lot of forces in northern Iraq, we can have them there. And the deal I think we ought to cut is with the Turks. We should demand that they accept that we are going to be the guarantor that the Kurds are not going to declare independence.
Mm-hmm.
And in exchange, they agree to leave the place alone. And in the end, the deal we ought to cut with the Kurds is we'll give them large autonomy in exchange for their promise not to declare independence. Well, that's the way to cut things.
It hasn't been cut that way yet. We're talking tonight about the air assault on Baghdad and where we are now in the war on Iraq. You can join the conversation. Do you see a strategy emerging from the smoke and dust? And how soon do you now think this war can be wrapped up? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point today, a series of many airstrikes. Officials have called it simply A Day for Air Power Day over Baghdad. Tonight, we're bringing you firsthand reports from the ground and full analysis of where the war stands now. You can join the conversation. What do you see unfolding in the war on Iraq? How soon do you think this might be wrapped up, or do we have a long, tough road to go? We've heard reports tonight of Turkish troops coming over the border. Of course, there have been some 5,000 right along the border for some time now, but perhaps pushing deeper into the Kurdish northern region of Iraq. Before those reports came through this evening, I spoke with WBUR's Michael Goldfarb in Erbil, Kurdistan in northern Iraq, where he heard today's bombing of Mosul. I asked him what he'd seen.
This evening, for the first time since the conflict began, we actually had some action up here. About 9 p.m. local time, there was a series of explosions over the town of Mosul, which is maybe 30 miles from where I'm talking to you from, Tom. We drove to the border that exists between the semi-autonomous Kurdish region and Iraq proper, where I've been spending the last few nights, and saw one jet with final sortie of the evening. The whole action lasted for about 1 hour, and then it's gone silent again.
How is it being received in the Kurdish area where you are, Michael Goldfarb?
Well, I think it's absolutely welcome. There's no doubt about this. At least this is one corner of the world that really endorses the American-British war against Saddam Hussein's regime. These people have longed to be rid of him and are very happy that it's happening. These first few days of war, when there was no action up here, the first day everyone was extremely hopeful, the second day everybody was a little disappointed. Then today they've been in anticipating action, because throughout the day a number of Peshmerga fighters began to arrive here in Erbil, many more than I've seen in the last 2 or 3 days. And everyone is anticipating that there's going to be quite a bit of action over the next few days. But the ground communication here is very, very difficult. And so it's very hard to see what the full pattern is, because it's hard to contact officials.
Michael Goldfarb, are the Peshmerga, the Kurdish troops, chomping at the bit to themselves get into Mosul, get into Iraq proper, or are they waiting on U.S. troops?
At the moment, they're actually waiting on their orders. They've agreed to come under U.S. command. It's very clear that the U.S. is in a very delicate political situation up here. Tom, as you know, there have been these intensive negotiations with Turkey. The Turks would be very, very unhappy indeed if Peshmerga guerrillas were to somehow get in after U.S. bombing and get to Mosul and Kirkuk before U.S. troops. This would make the Turkish army very nervous. So I think that the Kurds are being asked to hold their fire. And again, this is kind of informed speculation from the ground, that because the U.S. doesn't have the complement of troops in Turkey to bring them in, we don't have the full complement of American soldiers here yet. So it seems that there's still a bit of waiting to be done before things happen on the ground. Listeners should really pay attention to what's happening in the negotiations between the U.S. and Turkey about just how the Turks are going to help us militarily, because that will affect the speed of the campaign here.
And finally, Michael, is there any sign of U.S. troops in northern Iraq in the Kurdish area, regular troops or special forces, any sign at all at this point?
Well, special forces had been sighted here even a week or two ago. I personally have not seen any special forces troops. And in fact, I spent much of today going to several villages where the word was out that you might just encounter special forces. If they're here, they stay hidden. There's also some speculation that elements of the 101st Airborne, who are down south in Kuwait, have flown up through Iraqi airspace, not violating Turkish airspace, and may be on the ground here this evening. We'll have to wait and see how the information dribbles into us, because, as I say, in this part of the world, ground communication is extremely difficult.
Michael, thank you for speaking with us.
My pleasure, Tom.
That was WBUR's Michael Goldfarb reporting from Erbil in Kurdish-held northern Iraq. We're talking tonight about the air assault on Baghdad and where we stand now in the war on Iraq. You're welcome to join us at 1-800-423-8255. Kevin is on the line. Welcome, Kevin. You're on the air.
Yes. The supposed rationale for this war, and actually for possible future wars, is that preventive war is necessary, first strike preventive war, because weapons of mass destruction that could do great damage to the planet and the people who live on it. Mm.
One of a number of motives
cited. Mm-hmm. Cannot be deterred.
Yes.
But if we're about to end their regime, and they're not going to use those supposed weapons now, isn't it true that they would have never have used them? And if the argument is that this is not unlike the first Gulf War, that they were deterred in using them, then wasn't deterrent a policy that we should never have abandoned in the first place?
Tough question. General Ulstrom, your response.
Well, Kevin, I think to start with is that intent to use weapons of mass destruction is very, very hard to read. in this particular case, the administration has made the case that Saddam has been willing to use them and has used them. And with great uncertainty, there's a feeling that he continues to hold weapons of mass destruction. The fear is that he will somewhere down the road, at his choosing. And it's very hard to predict whether or not he would or would not use them in this particular conflict. We still have to see that. And I don't know, I can't read his mind whether or not it would be today or tomorrow or if at all.
Stephen Van Evere, what about it? And to the heart of Kevin's question, he's saying if Saddam doesn't use them now, when his life is clearly on the line, if indeed he's not been injured or more already, which seems a possibility, but if he's not using them now, does that indicate he might never have? Or are you expecting that we may still see them as U.S. troops approach Baghdad?
Well, there's several points. One is that the weapons that have worried us most that he might have are nuclear weapons. And everyone agrees that he doesn't have them yet. And the big debate is over whether he would get them in, say, 3 to 5 years if we don't go to war, or perhaps never if we don't go to war. The British intelligence has suggested that if we maintain a tight sanctions regime, we would have frozen his nuclear program. He never would have built them.
But the more acute threat, at least as described and publicized by Washington, running up to this war was the chemical and biological.
Correct.
I mean, because they were supposedly already developed and waiting to pull up out of the sand somewhere.
Correct. And I guess we will learn something about his willingness to use WMD in this war. He's in something of an awkward position if he uses them in this war because he spent the last 9 months claiming he didn't have any. So if he does use them, he's giving a lie to all of his claims over the last 9 months. If his regime is going down, this point of rhetoric or credibility isn't very important. But we haven't seen yet if he's going to use them. As I was saying to Tad over break, I think one of the major questions still out there is, are we going to encounter bio or chem attacks? And I'm expecting them, actually.
So one indication, expectation in your mind that this thing is a long way from over yet.
Yes.
Shahzad is calling from Boston. Hi, Shahzad. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm talking about Turkish regime. I think it's much worse than Saddam Hussein regime. If they in charge with the north of Iraq, in Kurdistan, they're going to stay there because a lot of field oil there. And I was in Kurdistan before 3 years ago.
Are you Kurdish, Shahzad?
Yes, I'm Kurdish from north of Iraq.
So you feel quite threatened by the idea that Turkish troops might be pushing further into northern Iraq?
Yeah, I heard from the news they're going to inch to the north of Iraq. And everybody, I mean every Kurdish person outside of Iraq and north and inside of the north of Iraq, they don't like that, and we support the President Bush 100%.
But not Turks coming in. We've got that loud and clear. I guess, General Ulstrom, this goes again to the speed with which U.S. troops can, at this point, really cover the entire country. What's your expectation? We're still pushing it from the south, 100 and some, perhaps, miles in there now, at least some troops. Could we leapfrog Baghdad and begin to see U.S. troops in greater numbers in the north soon? We've been bombing in the north. Does that look like a prelude to insertion of troops?
You got to realize that the area that we're talking about is another 200 miles north of Baghdad. I don't have an expectation that we can be leapfrogging with the troops that are now en route to Baghdad. Certainly there might be some opportunities to take smaller elements in a circuitous route to take them up to the north that might help the stability. I personally think that this is going to be more of a diplomatic problem with Turkey than it is a military problem with Turkey. One of the things that I would suggest is let's find something for the Turkish troops to do other than looking at the Kurds.
Such as?
Well, how about protecting oil fields for us?
But wouldn't that drive the Kurds crazy? They don't want the Turks. Neither side wants the Turks or the other around those fields.
But somebody needs to do that. Mm-hmm. They are going to be there anyhow. Why not give them a mission of some sort? The other thing we talked about is is the fact this is a wonderful opportunity for the European Union or the NATO to start talking to the Turks as well, because the
leverage.
Turks need to be part of that part of Europe.
Even in war, even on the day of the big air assault, diplomacy is still always in the background. General Ahlstrom, thank you very much for being with us tonight. Retired Lieutenant General of the Air Force, Tad Ahlstrom, and Stephen Van Evra, always great to have you. Thanks for coming in. Stephen Van Evra, Director of MIT's Security Studies Program. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, reflections from Kuwait City. This is On Point. In the coming weeks, we will be bringing you radio diaries from reporters in and around Iraq who will share stories of how the war is affecting ordinary people in the region. Tonight, we hear from the Boston Globe's Thanasi Kambanis in Kuwait City. Yesterday, Iraq launched at least 4 missiles into Kuwait. The Pentagon says Patriot missiles intercepted 2 of them, and 2 others landed harmlessly. In Kuwait City, air raid sirens were heard several times throughout the day. In this radio diary, Thanasi Kambanis says Kuwaitis are taking the missile attacks from Iraq in stride.
Yesterday was the day that the missiles started coming down in Kuwait. And the Kuwaitis themselves, the first air raid sirens went off around noon or 12:30. And during the first raids, the Kuwaitis went inside. But by the second and third raids, you could see people out in the streets. And we were actually in an area called Salwa, which is a fancy residential area on the coast, and kids were playing in the streets, and people were going shopping, going to the gas station as if nothing was going on. They didn't really want it to interfere with their lives. The conventional wisdom here is that all the nervous people left already a long time ago. So what you have left are people who have a sort of disarming fatalism. I was talking to a man tonight at a fish market, and a missile actually came down here last night, right next to where he works, and he said, "God is great," put his hands up in the air and said, "He'll take care of us." And that seems to be the prevailing attitude. Now, a lot of these people can't afford the kinds of fancy gas masks and chemical suits that the military has and that most of the reporters have. So if they didn't have that acceptance, there really wouldn't be much they could do about it anyway if a chemical shell landed here. Around 10:30, I actually heard a missile coming in from the north and saw a blinding flash of light just south of the hotel over the Persian Gulf. It turns out 2 small missiles, probably silkworms, had been fired under the air defenses, didn't set off any alarms, and had landed right next to our hotel. So we went down tonight to actually look at the neighborhood next to where it landed, and this is a stenchy fish market on the water, and there people seem to think it was almost funny. You know, they were telling us how they were eating dinner when it came in, pantomiming the noise, and they didn't seem to take it seriously at all, which was a refreshing bit of perspective, I guess. The Iraqi occupation is still very much alive for Kuwaitis today. In our American recollection of the Gulf War, we don't, speaking for myself anyway, hadn't thought as much about the fact that they spent 7 months almost under a pretty brutal occupation. And so for them, this is a wonderful, not payback, but a wonderful form of justice in their eyes. And so, you know, whatever fear they have of any retaliation from Iraq is totally outweighed by their support for unseating him. Unlike in the States, where there is some debate over this war, here it's difficult to find, as a reporter, people who think this is a bad idea. Most everyone I've talked to is 100% behind any war that gets rid of Saddam Hussein.
Thanasi Kambanis is covering the war for the Boston Globe. He shared his observations from Kuwait City. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is W.